Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. 11 women went missing over the spring and summer of 1988 in New Bedford, Massachusetts, an old fishing port known as the Whaling City. In Shallow Graves, investigative reporter Maureen Boyle tells the story of a case that has haunted New England for 30 years. The crimes, the skeletal remains of nine of the women aged 19 to 36, were discovered near highways around New Bedford. Some had clearly been strangled, others were so badly decomposed that police were left to guess how they had died. The investigators, Massachusetts State Troopers Marianne Dill and Josie Gonsalves, were the two constants in a complex cast of city, county, and state cops and prosecutors. They knew the victims, the suspects, and the drug and crime-riddled streets of New Bedford. They were present at the beginning of the case, and they stayed to the bitter end. The suspects, Kenneth Ponte, a New Bedford attorney and deputy sheriff with an appetite for drugs and prostitutes, landed in the investigative crosshairs from the start. He was indicted by a grand jury in the murder of one of the victims, but those charges were later dropped. Anthony DiGrazia was a loner who appeared to befit the classic serial killer profile, horrific childhood abuse, charming, charismatic, but prone to bursts of violence. He hunted prostitutes in the city by day and served at a Catholic church by day. Which of these two was the real killer, or was it someone else entirely? Maureen Boyle first broke the story in 1988 and stayed with it for decades, drawing on more than 100 interviews, along with police reports, first-person accounts, and field reporting both during the killings and more recently. Shallow Graves brings the reader behind the scenes of the investigation onto the streets of the city and into the homes of the families still hoping for answers. The book that we're featuring this evening is Shallow Graves, The Hunt for the New Bedford Highway Serial Killer, with my special guest, journalist and author, Maureen Boyle. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Maureen Boyle.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me, Dan. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate you spreading word about this case.
Well, thank you very much.
Everyone in the community.
Incredible.
I appreciate it.
Yes. Thank you. It's an incredible book and an incredible case, and thank you for this. Tell us first how you came to be the author of Shallow Graves. How did you become first involved with this case? Tell us a little bit about that.
In 1988, I was a reporer at the Standard Times of New Bedford. That's a daily newspaper in New Bedford, Massachusetts. I've been a long-time police reporter and had done a number of pieces and about some drug-addicted women who are working the streets in the city. You have to go back to 1988 where people really didn't talk about opiate addiction like they do today. And
right.
What I was discovering back then, before this case came out, that there was a number of women who had been assaulted on the street, who, because of their addiction, were putting themselves in harm's way, what people would consider harm's way. And I developed a real affinity for the women who were addicted and were really struggling to get out of that lifestyle, but really couldn't because of the draw of heroin and how it really had been in its grasp. Back in 88, slowly I noticed that women started going missing. There was a detective in the New Bedford PD who was looking at one particular disappearance, and almost by happenstance, he discovered that a number of other women had gone missing. They didn't all go missing all at once. They were all adults. So there really was not any big alarm initially because the bodies hadn't, the remains didn't show up immediately. The first body showed up on the 4th of July weekend in 1988 outside of New Bedford in a small town called Freetown on the highway. Second body showed up in Dartmouth, which is another town outside of New Bedford, at the end of July. And then another body was eventually found in August. And then they started showing up. I'm sorry, another one was found in October. So they all started showing up, not all at once. So it was there was no big alarm initially. But I was interested in it because of the sheer number of women who had gone missing and the detective's concern about it. And so I started reporting on the missing women, and as the bodies started showing up with increased frequency, or the skeletal remains, that's when we knew that there was a serial killer in the area.
As you write in the book, you introduced the character of Nancy Paiva, and also her mother Judy Santos, and her, and Nancy's daughter Jill. As you read in the book, Nancy, tell us a little bit about her life, just to demonstrate what you've been just talking about and alluding to. So tell us a little bit about the relationship that she had with her husband Frankie, and tell us a little bit about her life and her use of heroin. And what had happened?
Nancy was came from a working class, middle class family from the north end of New Bedford. They, parents owned a house. She got married, went to secretarial school, got a divorce. She had a child, got a divorce, developed a relationship with a long-term relationship with another person, had a second child. And then after that breakup, she got involved with an individual who obviously her family did not approve of. He was not from New Bedford. He had a criminal record, and it appears that he is the one who introduced her to heroin. She was not a heroin hardcore drug user prior to meeting him, and once she began using heroin, her life just fell apart. And she wound up, she disappeared while she was walking home she was going to court the next day, and she needed money for a court fine, and she just she expected that she's going to go to jail and was never seen again. But her background was middle-class family, working parents, intact family, and she did not start using heroin until she was in her 30s.
Right.
And right from the start, everything just fell apart. She's a loving mother. And her kids adored her.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, Dan. Yes.
You talk about and introduce Detective Dextre Duer, and you talk about the limited technology at that time in 1988. Just to remind people, it was a time of typewriters and payphones and whiteout when you made a mistake when you were typing. But tell us a little bit about Detective Dextre Duer, and also how he comes to think that there's a serial killer operating once these bodies start piling up, or these missing
people. Very good question. Yeah. John Dextrader is a longtime both homicide investigator and property crimes investigator. And he had investigated prior to this several murders that involved drug-addicted women, as well as several cases of vicious assaults on some of the drug-addicted women who were working the streets. And he was really appalled by what was going on there and started investigating these cases and wondering what kind of person would do these type of crimes. Because New Bedford is a very close-knit, small city. It's a type of city where even the crime statistics really are misleading, because if people see a crime, they report it. So sometimes the numbers are skewed as a result, but I consider it a relatively safe city. So he was very, very concerned about what was going on the streets and who is this person that is attacking women, and if we don't stop it now, it is just going to get worse and worse. So he was very attuned to these types of crimes. So he had come across Nancy Paiva's disappearance really by accident. He was at the police station, and he was near the front desk when Nancy's boyfriend at the time came in to report her missing. And John Dextrader was a detective, was really taken aback because the boyfriend had a long criminal record, and he would not have voluntarily gone into a police station on his own. So
right.
He was listening to what was going on and was wondering, okay, is this guy trying to set up an alibi for himself? Did he really kill his girlfriend? And he's setting it up like, oh, no, I'm really the concerned boyfriend. So eventually, you know, John took the police report and got in touch with Nancy's sister, Judy DeSantos, who worked at City Hall. And he was trying to track down where she might be and gathered some information, but not nearly enough at that time, because this was a missing persons case. This was not a homicide case at that time. We do have to remember 1988 was a different era. I mean, technology has changed so much in the last 31 years, and people sometimes forget that. Back in 1988, we didn't have smartphones. Surveillance cameras were primarily in banks, and those photos were really, really bad. People were not shooting video on the street like they are today. And DNA at that time was, there wasn't such a thing in the courts as touch DNA. Most crimes, investigators relied on blood types. Even when it came to fingerprints, not all fingerprints were in the AFIS system. As a matter of fact, in many states, departments were just starting to put their fingerprints into a centralized computerized system. For example, in New Bedford, they did not have their prints in there at that time. So it was a completely different era. It was really talking to people, walking the streets. Departments were not really talking to each other the way they do today. There wasn't that same ease. So he was really on an island at this point when he started the investigation. And as he was looking at Nancy's disappearance, he went into the record room, just going through some of the missing persons reports, and discovered, this would have been much later in the summer, discovered, oh my God, there are so many other women who have slowly gone missing over the course of the spring and the summer. And it wasn't like the women were gone missing every week. It was another month, and they're all adults, and these were all handwritten reports. So it piqued his interest because of the women's backgrounds. They were all drug addicted women, and they all disappeared or last seen in areas that were known for drug activity. So he took, after two bodies were found in July, he figured those were not, neither of them were Nancy's, although that would later turn out to be wrong. But after September, October, he went to the DA's office to share his concerns that, you know, here are all these missing women. We've got two women's bodies that were found on the highways. Could there be something more sinister going on? And thank goodness that the DA's office paid attention, and they brought in a specialized state trooper from Connecticut who had the best cadaver dog, that the dog that is trained to find dead people, brought him, made arrangements to bring him in, but before he was brought in, another body was found. But then when he came in, additional bodies were discovered along highways. So John really was key in the beginning of this case in bringing it to the DA's attention, and really getting the ball rolling. And then after that, the state police in Massachusetts, state police take the lead in homicide investigations. And you know, Josie Gonsalves and Mary Ann Dill were the two state troopers who then took over or led the investigation from then on there, along with a number of other individuals, both in the state police and the local department. What is unique about this case, even though all the women are believed to have gone missing from New Bedford, this is not a New Bedford homicide case because none of the bodies were found in New Bedford. They were found in some of the smaller communities that circle New Bedford. So if you think of it as a donut, with New Bedford in the center, and the bodies were found in a circle along the highways around there. So
it's very interesting when you talk about this incredible dog handler that comes in with this specifically trained, and we learn a lot reading about how these dogs are trained specifically for just one role their whole career or their whole life, and this is to be a cadaver dog. And you talk about how on just when they're going to wrap up a search, then there is a body found. Tell us a little bit about that unique search with this incredible dog, and also what they found at those sites that would give them some evidence or some clues to move forward in the investigation. Was there any evidence like that?
Yeah. Keep in mind, this is still, even after 31 years, this is still considered an open investigation. So they are very, very careful in Massachusetts of discussing exactly what evidence is found at a scene that could tie them to a suspect, which is one of the reasons why, and I'm asked this all the time about DNA. The district attorney's office and investigators have been very, very careful in discussing the possibility of any DNA evidence. They will not either confirm nor deny if they have DNA evidence. And part of the reason may be there could be evidence there that could not be tested in 1988 or 89, but could be tested in the future because DNA testing has in forensic testing really has changed dramatically over the past 31 years. So the short answer is they won't discuss what was found at the scene that could be tied to a suspect. If that answers your question.
Right.
Although things have been tested over the years, but they're very, very careful in what information is released on that end.
Now, you talk about the investigators obviously going through all of the potential suspects, even with Nancy Paiva. They looked at her husband that came forward or her common-law partner that came forward. They looked at everybody surrounding these cases. They had, of course, some wild goose chases and tips. You go through all of that. Tell us how they come to Kenneth Ponte, if that's the right pronunciation of this attorney, how he comes to be suspected.
Kenny Ponte was much younger. He was a heroin addict. And in some ways, he was the poster child for recovery because after he had been arrested for possession of needle and syringe and possession of heroin, he basically literally turned his life around. Went to college, went to law school, and eventually his record was expunged and he was able to become an attorney. However, addiction, as many people now know, is very, very insidious. And in the 1980s, cocaine came onto the market, and a lot of professionals were using coke, including him. However, he was an attorney, and he had a reputation to uphold, and he did not want to be seen as using and buying coke. So he had some of the girls that he knew from his previous life who were on the street. He would give them money, and they would buy drugs for him. They'd come to the house and use drugs with him. So he came to the attention by investigators because of his behavior. He knew all of the victims, though that is not all that unusual in a small city.
Right.
He knew all of the victims. There was a lot of very, very strange stories about his behavior with people and behavior with the girls when they were locked up in his house and they were using drugs. You know, I go into it a lot in great detail in the book, he's very strange. We'll put it that way. He would start hallucinating and seeing things. And some of the girls got a little bit nervous about it. Some of the other girls thought, oh, yeah, he's just crazy. But that is one of the reasons why he came to law enforcement attention. It wasn't because they just pulled his name out of a hat. They had good reason to look at him very, very carefully, and he was not very cooperative. As a matter of fact, he wasn't cooperative at all because he knew his rights and he was a lawyer and didn't have to talk to investigators, and that also got people a little bit concerned. So he moved to the top of the list in terms of suspects for quite some time. And added to it, he also moved to Florida about 2 months after the last victim went missing. So the timing of that, along with his demeanor, his background, and his knowledge of all the victims, really put him right in the laser focus from the law enforcement.
Now, just to add to all of this, you talk about the leak of information. What does this leak of information do in terms of this case regarding the media?
I mean, the leak of information in terms of at that time?
Well, when does the information that he's come to the attention of the police,
when
is that information leaked, and what is the repercussions from that?
Oh yeah, when it came out for a couple of months, they'd been kind of talking to him. He was a very strange man. When it came out publicly that he was a quote unquote suspect or a person of interest, he at that point just stopped all talking with police and got very, very paranoid at that point. So that did cause a rift, if you will, between him and law enforcement, and that's kind of ramped up the pressure on him. So I think if his name had not come out publicly, I don't know how this case may have veered off in a different direction. But it did cause some issues at that point, because he was then in the spotlight and he got very, very defensive.
Mm-hmm.
And some would argue, you know, rightly so.
Now, when he decides, you say 2 months after the last body, and we didn't go through these bodies being found and the investigation up to that point, and who becomes involved in this investigation, a team is formed to look at this case a lot more clearly. What happens, though, when he moves to Florida? What do police do as a result of his move?
They go down there. They talk with them. Police down there are keeping a close eye on him because, obviously, if someone moves into your town and their name is mentioned in a murder investigation, you're going to want to know, if you're a cop, you're going to want to know what they're doing, and you're going to keep an eye on him. So he, some of his behaviors, his weirdness, so to speak, did kind of follow him down there. Police had been called on different occasions for disturbances at his house. But they did, Massachusetts authorities at different times did go down there just to watch his house and things like that.
You introduce a character as... Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. And, you know, and eventually he did get in some... had some problems with a woman that he met down there. No, that he met... Well, he met through letters, and she flew down there to spend some time with him. And there was a domestic issue, and he wound up in jail on charges down there.
Tell our audience, as you do in the book, about an important character named Bob St. Jean. What does Bob St. Jean do for this investigation?
Yeah, Bob St. Jean was a former state trooper who worked for the district attorney's office. The way it works in Massachusetts, there is a number of state police officers who are assigned to different district attorneys, a special unit assigned to the DA's office. And they investigate homicides and white-collar crimes and drug crimes, a variety of those types of things. And he eventually left the state police and was hired as the chief investigator for the DA's office. So he's sort of straddled the civilian side and the state police side, because there had been some political issues during one of the elections. And he helped coordinate between the state police and some of the local police in the investigation. And he had spoken to Kenny Pont on various occasions to try to get him to provide additional information on the case, as well as working with some narcotics detectives who were also drawn into the case because of the drug element that was involved.
You talk about the district attorney, Ronald Pina, and we'll talk about later about his political fight, which happens during this grand jury arraignment. Let's talk about District Attorney Ronald Pina, and when does he get involved, and when he gets involved, what does he want to do?
What does Ron? Okay, so with Ron's eventual political fight, but I mean, these type of cases, especially in small communities, there is always a political element to it, or people try to introduce politics into criminal justice cases, which, you know, personally, I think is a wrong thing to do. Politics should never be involved in law enforcement. But it, unfortunately, if people have got to be elected for a job, it does become an issue. And, you know, before this case, Ron had been in a been involved in a re-election bid where he was up against a state trooper's brother. The brother lost, and Ron had some hard feelings with state police. And then as a result of this case, he also faced a really tough challenger for re-election again in the case. So in some ways, this case did become a lightning rod locally in politics. Ron Pina was a very bright, very articulate individual, very good-looking, very well-spoken, and had a lot of very high-profile cases during his tenure, and you know, type of high-profile cases that draw a lot of media attention, such as what's known as the Big Dan's case, which was a gang rape case here in New Bedford in the 1980s. and that got people concerned in the community. In the prosecution of that, they thought that it was overblown, or it was showing the city in a bad light. He had been involved in a number of other gaming cases, a whole slew of types of cases. So in some ways, Ron became a lightning rod, political lightning rod. People either loved him or they hated him. And this case drew a lot of attention and a lot of attention on the city, a lot of attention to him, and it became a campaign issue. In some ways, some people thought that Kenny Pont was unjustly being pursued as a suspect, that it was he was being prosecuted to win an election. So it became Ron's handling of the case, and the case itself became political when it should not have been.
You talk about Kenneth Ponte communicating with the DA, which is, I would say, somewhat unusual. What was the gist of the conversations? What did Pont have to say to the district attorney?
Well, most of his conversations went through Bob St. Jean. Any of his conversations with the DA were more public, through his attorney and things like that. He didn't really have, face-to-face conversations with Ron Pino. Mm-hmm. They all went through some of the investigators.
Mm-hmm.
And
when
towards
you talk
the
about...
end, he had very hard feelings, obviously, for the district attorney.
And what would he say to Bob St. Jean? What would Bob say to him? How did Bob feel about the treatment that was given to Pont through the media? Did he feel any empathy? What was it?
Bob St. Jean is a very, very highly trained investigator, and he would obviously just let him know that there was, they were just wanted answers and just wanted him to help with the investigation and would just, press him in that regard and insist that they had nothing to do with anything that was released to the press.
Mm-hmm.
That the whatever the press was doing was not his choice.
Tell us about the grand jury and Kenneth Pont.
Yeah. The district attorney had decided to host a special grand jury, hold a special grand jury in this case. It was an investigative grand jury, primarily to get these people's recollections and the information on the record so that there would be sworn testimony in the case.
Right.
So that if someone died or something like that, If someone died or something like that, they would not be they would still have the information on record.
Right.
So this went on for quite some time. Now, the media was outside the DA's office for quite some time. Outside the courthouse for quite some time. The grand jury is secret, so people are in the giving their testimony before the grand jurors, and the media is outside. They can see who's going in there, but they don't know what's being said. So when the people would leave the courthouse, reporters would ask the witnesses, "What did they ask you? What did you say?" And this went on for quite some time. However, what's interesting about this, and, I was there at the time. I experienced what was going on and through the research of the book, and I was able to obtained some of the grand jury information, what the reporters thought was being said at that time was not necessarily what was being said there. And the direction of the grand jury really was very, very investigative, particularly in the early stages. The information that they were gathering from people is not necessarily what the public thought was going on. The public, through the news media, thought the grand jury was targeting Kenneth Pont, especially in the early stages, when in fact it really was a very wide net of suspects that they were looking at. The grand jury looked at a variety of people, looked at as well as the investigators. The investigators looked at a wide range of suspects in the case, ranging from fishermen to even cops. They looked at people who were picking up girls on the street. They looked at businessmen. They looked at lawyers. They looked at doctors. You name it, they looked at them. And some of those individuals were called into the grand jury to address some of the DA's concerns, and also as a fact-finding finding mission. So the grand jury's mission initially was to get the facts, get it on record, because some of the witnesses, potential witnesses, were addicted to drugs or were in recovery or diagnosed with HIV. And in the 1980s and 80s and 90s, they didn't have the same drug cocktails that you have today.
Right.
And it was considered a death sentence by many. So they really wanted to get all this information on the record so that they would have it for years to come. And, or God forbid, someone OD'd before they could get the information from them. So by having it on the record, they can still continue this very, very, very difficult investigation. But it was a bit of a zoo, I have to say, with the grand jury in terms of the way the situation was created outside the courthouse, because you had television reporters, radio reporters, print reporters all gathered outside waiting for witnesses to come out, waiting for the DA to come out. It was secret. The testimony was secret, but who was going in and out really wasn't. And that also created the impression to the public that this was a circus rather than an investigation, which it was not the case.
Outside of the public opinion and their perception, what were legal onlookers? How were they assessing this grand jury, special grand jury, and the results?
Some of them, obviously, they were very concerned about the attention that was portrayed to one of their own, and wondering, you know, why were different names being out there in the public view? If someone isn't charged with a crime, why is their name being dragged out in public? So that they're, quote unquote, painted as a killer when they're not being charged with it. So there was some concern in that regard of how the secret proceeding was being handled, because of some of it was the logistics of where the courthouse was and where the grand jury met. The grand jury met in New Bedford Superior Court, which is a very historic courthouse. They met in a first floor. They had two courtrooms in there, one downstairs, one upstairs, and there's a grand jury room, which is a smaller room. And if you were in the hallway, you could see who's walking in and who's walking out. It really was no secret how many people were being called in there. You may not know what they said, but you know who went in and you know how long they were in there for.
Now, we alluded to and we mentioned another person that was a suspect, which was Anthony DeGrazia. Tell us about him and why he becomes a viable suspect.
Tony DeGrazia became a suspect further into the investigation, because a number of the women who are on the street had, who were very concerned about their own lives at this point and their own safety, had brought him to their attention. They were describing a man who was sexually assaulting and attacking and choking women that he would pick up on the street. He would, quote unquote, choke them out. He'd choke them until they lost consciousness and then sexually assault them. They gave him a description. They eventually ID'd and arrested Anthony DeGrazia on a series of attacks on women. So because of, you know, the nature of the victims, who the victims were, and the nature of the attacks, he definitely moved to the top of the list as a potential suspect. And there was a number of, he had a number of alleged victims that he was charging. So he also had a very interesting background, to say the least. He had two previous rape arrests, but he was acquitted on both of them. And I go into them in detail about one in particular involving two teenage girls. But he had a sad upbringing. It was alleged that he was abused as a child. So that came to play in terms of looking at the profile of an individual and a criminal profile. So that also came to play in, like, oh, could it possibly be him?
Mm-hmm.
But so the two of them were two of the two of several main suspects that were examined. There were that came into the public eye. That said, there was a number of other people who also were examined, and they could not really pinpoint, if they were or were not the killer. There just wasn't enough evidence in it to move it forward.
Getting back to the grand jury decision, we talked about the political situation that Rob Pina was in and his future as a district attorney. Tell us what happens with the grand jury that was arraigned, and then what happens with the Pina's bid for re-election, and what happens as a result with this case, with the new DA.
Kenny Pont had been indicted by the grand jury on one count of homicide involving one of the victims who had been staying with him. This was prior to the election. He was in a primary battle with an individual by the name of Paul Walsh, who came from a very well politically connected family. And when Paul won the election, won the primary, which was a Democratic primary. There were no Republicans on the ballot, so essentially it's a winner take all primary. And he won, and Ron was gone. The reason why I think he won was because of this case, because Kenny Pont had been indicted so close to the election. People were concerned that he was indicted only to score political points, only to win the election.
And when they looked at the information gathered from this grand jury as well, there wasn't any ties. There was no ties legally for him for this to move forward to indictment.
But we have to remember when people are indicted, it is not the grand jury does not have to be unanimous. in an indictment. It's not like it is with a trial. So all the grand jurors did not have to agree on it, as long as it was a majority and they moved it forward. And they had been meeting for you know, well over a year. It was, you know, the grand jury from hell if you were sitting on it, because you were in there a long, long time, on and off. It wasn't every single day, but it was grueling for average people who got, you know, called to jury duty, and next thing you know, they're sitting on a special grand jury. But the when Paul Walsh took over as a district attorney, the first thing he did was review the case, and he brought in a special prosecutor, someone who is not from Bristol County, someone who had no local political ties, and part of that was to take away that the shadow that somehow this was a politically motivated case. So he brought in a special prosecutor, Paul Buckley, who is very well respected in the Boston area. And, well, first Paul went through all the evidence with the investigators, box by box, piece by piece, and then the special investigator did the same, went through every bit of information in the case. And he told me he had every intention of prosecuting the case. He just wanted to know, okay, how am I going to build my case here? And as they were going through it, he realized they did not have enough evidence to not only not win the case, they didn't have enough evidence, hard evidence, to bring it to trial, that a judge would just toss it out. And rather than have it being tossed out with prejudice, which means that if additional evidence came forward against Kenny Pont, they couldn't prosecute him, they just dropped the case.
Right. Now,
so
you talk about two. Go ahead.
So it wasn't a it did not clear Kenny Pont. It just said that there wasn't enough evidence to bring it to trial.
There was a woman named Diane Doherty, if we go backwards just a little bit, at this grand jury. And she talked about a woman that lived with Pont, which was Rochelle. And tell us what she had said, and despite what she said, what was the result of the information that she provided?
Well, Diane Doherty gave some conflicting information to authorities, and as a result, you know, initially that played into the indictment, but when it came down to actually moving the case forward, they could not. They didn't find her as a viable witness for it. So, you know, Diane had told a variety of different crazy stories that they seemed just too crazy, or too far fetched later to for it to matter. I mean, the stories that she told ranged and. Without getting into too much detail of her, they ultimately did not. Initially, they sort of bought what she was saying, but later on did not. You know, she was making allegations that he admitted that he did kill one of the victims, and that played a role into the, I think, into the indictment.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about Tony DeGrazia, and you talk about his fate. You talk about, obviously, Kenneth Pont's, his fate. You talk about the detective, Doug Stradur, and his son getting into the police. But we've, throughout this entire book, and we haven't really mentioned it, is the plight of Sister Judy Santos with her sister Nancy Paiva finally being identified and the entire challenge and battle and her hopes dashed with this entire thing. Tell us a little bit about Judy Santos and that fight to find justice for her sister.
Judy DeSantos, over the years, really, and part of it is because she's, you know, living in New Bedford, was able to really keep on pushing and keep on highlighting the case to local authorities, as well as Nancy's children, who, you know, they're now adults. She, whenever possible, will, you know, just keep on asking about it. However, some other families of other victims, one of especially Deborah Greenwald DeMello, her brother and her daughter are very, very active in pushing for justice for her. That was another victim in the case. So there's two families that are really pushing forward to this day, searching for justice, just trying to keep the case alive. Neither of them will really rest until the killer is identified. You know, it's after 31 years, a variety of things could have happened. You know, the killer could be dead. The killer could be in jail. The killer could have moved. The killer could have just stopped. But if the killer is dead, I think the public really deserves to know who he is, just so that they can put the case to rest in their minds. There'll never be justice if the person is dead, because the person hasn't gone on trial. But at least the families and the community at large will know who the person was, and they won't always be looking over their shoulder. The other issue in terms of justice is that, you know, the 9 bodies have been found, but there are still 2 victims that are out there that have not been located. Christine Montero and another individual, another woman, whose parents have, this is an interesting situation here. Marilyn Cardoza Roberts, her father was a retired New Bedford cop, and she went missing in the spring of 1980, and she has not been found. And Christine Montero, who is the youngest victim, she's 19. Her mother was engaged to a Dartmouth police officer, and her remains have not been found. So that there's a number of people who have said, and I think, and I would argue wrongly, that enough attention had not been paid to this case because the women were drug addicted, and if they were the daughters or sisters of police officers, the case would have been solved. However, in these 2 cases, you know, you did have 2 victims who were tied to, who did have relatives tied to law enforcement. And those that were investigating the case really did want to solve it. And it had nothing to do with, oh, we don't care because of their addiction.
In terms of
Judy's, you know, the families really are, even after all these years, really committed to justice, because it really is a gaping hole in their hearts. They cannot, it's unresolved. It will always be there. And as they move forward and, you know, their children reach the age where they're older than where, than their mothers. It's very, very sad that there's, you know, there's all of these milestones in their children's lives that these women never got to see. And most of the women were mothers, and their children grew up without them. Mm-hmm. And the children never got to see their mothers recover from their addiction and, you know, reenter their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you really delve into the relative normalcy of these people's lives and the close family lives that they had, despite this tag of drug-addicted prostitute and that reality. In terms of the suspects, Tony DeGrazia and Kenneth Pont, what happened to Tony DeGrazia? And then tell us what has happened to Kenneth Pont.
Well, I detail all of that in the book of what had happened to them. But, you know, their fates were very, very sad. But going back to the prostitution element, not all of the women had records of prostitution. The women, the common denominator in the case is drug addiction. And, you know, a couple of the women had records for prostitution. And because of their addiction, women may have been in situations where they were they could be compromised, but not all of them were prostitutes. And even those that were, most of the women who were not the ones who were always out on the street. Those were the ones who survived. So whoever it was that killed them were able to win their trust in a certain way. And, you know, this is a very, very small city. And where the women were found, at least I believe that it is someone local or was local, someone who knows the area, because there is the way the roads are and where the women were found. It was not someone who just, you know, popped into the area briefly and disappeared. They really, they did have some type of a tie to the community. And it does seem that they really were trying to avoid the city of New Bedford, because none of the women were found in the city, and it's believed all the women were taken from the city. And you know, all of the women would have known each other because of the nature of a small community. I have told people in the past that the women would have known each other because they were in that same circle of buying drugs, just as, you know, doctors know doctors, teachers know teachers, educators know educators. In the drug culture, you know, those that are addicted know other addicts, and they know dealers. So that would not be unusual. So as a result, Kenny Pont, for example, he knew all of the victims, but in a small circle like drug dealing or drug buying, drug addiction, that might not be that unusual, especially given his previous history with addiction. And he was always in New Bedford. He did not live elsewhere. So it was, it raised flags, but it also made sense too. But overall, has been a very tragic, tragic story for everyone involved. And I really hope that either through forensic science or through the public, someone will be able to come forward and say, okay, I know who the killer is. Not that I think it is, or, you know, oh, this guy is really suspicious, that they know of, they were either there or they heard this person tell them that they did it. And I really think that there is someone out there who holds the key to the case. They may not have been willing to come forward back then because they were afraid of the individual. They may have had drug issues of their own. There's a variety of reasons why someone may not come forward then. You know, now they're much older. They have kids of their own, maybe grandkids. They've left the area. They're sober. And their life circumstances are very, very different. So I really hope that those the people who or person who has the key to the case can come forward and find it in their heart and be courageous and contact law enforcement in Bristol County in New Bedford to say this is a person who is the killer and this is the reason why. Not because I think it is or, you know, this person's crazy, but because this is, I was there. Or he came home and said this. Or I witnessed it, you know, that type of thing. And I think that there is a witness out there or witnesses who hold that key because it has happened in the past.
What about the idea that DNA can solve this? I know that in 1980, there weren't the technological advances, but since then, and certainly the testing is much easier post 2000. Do you think there's any reason why DNA hasn't been used and there's been no exhumation of the two suspects, or what do you think about that and that possibility of DNA solving this?
DNA may be able to solve it at this point. The key will be any evidence that they have and being able to glean DNA from any evidence that they have. They do have the DNA of Kenny Pont and Tony DeGrazia, so they don't have to do anything in that regard. But the issue would be looking at any evidence that was from the scene and being able to glean any of the DNA and evidence from that through testing. So keep in mind, the bodies of the women were found months and months after they went missing. For example, Nancy Paiva was probably found the quickest. She went missing in beginning of July, and she was found the end of July. However, her remains were largely skeletal by the time she was found because it was just such a hot, hot summer. It was unbelievable. And it was so her remains were largely skeletal, and all of the other remains also were basically skeletal. So there was not an awful lot that could be found at the scene at that time, but they did preserve a lot of evidence. And, you know, even taking into things that have been degraded over time, as testing continues to improve, they may be able to get some DNA in the future that can be entered into a system. But, you know, we wind up in a very false sense of knowledge when it comes to DNA, because we see so many things on TV, on cop shows, there's touch DNA or there's DNA here, and bingo, within an hour, you know, we have a suspect. And it's really not that simple, as you know. And when you're looking at older DNA, and especially from scenes that have been out in the element, it's really, really difficult to get the right type of sample for testing, for the right type of test. So as, you know, as we continue to keep going, they may be able to get some a match. Who knows? But I really think it will come down to the old-fashioned someone comes forward, old school investigating.
It's
and
been
maybe
so many
that's
times
in confession.
And it's interesting in your book because there's so many times when it looked like that was going to happen, that the case was going to be solved by the old fashioned manner, that people had come forward, they had said some things, and then all these hopes for the victims' families were dashed. You know, saying nine victims, two more potential. 11 potential victims of this mysterious serial killer. I want to thank you very much, Maureen, for coming on and talking about Shallow Graves, the hunt for the New Bedford Highway serial killer. For those people that might want to take a look at your work, tell us how they might find this book. Is it a Facebook page or a website? Tell us about that.
Yeah, the website is shallowgravesthebook.com. The website, that's the website. You can follow me on Twitter for those that are on Twitter. Maureen E. Boyle 1. I think that's my Twitter. You know how that goes sometimes, you forget.
Yeah.
you know, you create a new one because you forget your password.
Sure.
Maureen E. Boyle, B-O-Y-L-E, and number one. The Facebook page is Shallow Graves Hunt from New Bedford, a serial killer, and it is with a colon, not a semicolon. There's another page out there with a semicolon that's run by Wayne Perry, who is the brother of one of the victims. There's another page, Shallow Graves, and I have an author's page. You can get the book through Amazon and Barnes & Noble and through your local bookstore. Ask for it by name.
Absolutely.
and order it. And
absolutely.
So there's a variety of ways.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Maureen Boyle, for coming on and talking about Shallow Graves, the hunt for the New Bedford Highway serial killer. It's been fascinating. Thank you very much, Maureen Boyle. Good night.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. I greatly appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.